Good morning. Thank you. Welcome back to week number 12, which is going to be all in English this time. We have a lot to talk about today, so we'll get right into it. Don Chambers will lead us in our opening prayer. Amen. Thank you. Okay, first thing, when does this take place? Well, the text doesn't say specifically, but there is one clue in the text that helps us place it chronologically. And that is, it mentions in verse 28, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, was high priest at that time. Now, Phinehas was born, we're told, in Exodus 6:25, when he was born, apparently in Egypt. So he was already there. He's the one who at Peor, when the Midianite woman, as they were about to enter the promised land, or getting close, they came by the Midianites, and the Midianite women were leading the people astray, and one man in the camp brought the woman in, right by everybody else, and goes into his tent. Phinehas was the one who took a spear and killed them both. This is the same one. So having lived through that period, through the period of the judges, and considering what's going on at this time period, you'd probably think that this is past the period when the elders who had known Joshua and were helping Israel to stay faithful. It was probably past that period. So Phinehas would have been a very old man by this time, but he's still there. So this probably places us somewhere within the first 50 years or so. To be very conservative, the first 100 years, but probably within the first 50 years after Joshua died. So this is early in the period, relatively early in the period of the judges. Oops, really helps to turn it on. Okay, this 19 through 21, I think you could say, is one of the darkest accounts in the entire Bible. It is just a lot of nasty stuff going on. And we are going to try to look at this without getting caught up in emotions and say what's actually happening here and what can we learn from it. It's difficult to read because, our natural reaction is all sorts of revulsion. In 19, we'll just kind of walk our way through the story here. There was a Levite from the hill country of Ephraim. Now, in the previous two chapters, the Levite was from Bethlehem, and he was on his way to Ephraim. He ended up in Ephraim, and then was taken by the Danites as they went to the far north. Here we have the Levite from Ephraim who goes to Bethlehem and took a concubine for himself. Now you might say, why is this Levite taking a concubine? Did he already have a wife? And this was a secondary woman? Was there something about her that she didn't qualify to be good enough to be his wife? We don't know. We don't have any clues given to us. Some versions or some translations say she was unfaithful. The New American Standard says she played the harlot. Anyway, she returned to her father in Bethlehem. And he waited 4 months, and then he went after her. He missed her so much, he waited 4 months. I don't know how you understand this is a good question. Why did he wait so long? Was it because of indifference? Some arrogance? You know, I'm not going after her, and then decides later. We don't know. Just trying to get inside people's heads here. So he went to get her at Bethlehem, and the father-in-law, he was called father-in-law, and the Levite was called her husband, but the father-in-law was glad to meet him. Does that mean he had never seen him before? You know, it sounds like he'd never seen him before. He was glad to meet him, and he was very, very hospitable. He seemed to be just thrilled to have this man in his house. They kept him there eating and drinking and having a fine time. Kept him for 3 days, and then on the fourth day he wanted to leave, and he said, oh, eat something and strengthen yourself. And then the day wore on, and he finally said, well, it's too late, so stay another night. And on the fifth day they got up, and they were going to leave, and he says, oh, have a piece of bread and strengthen yourself. And so he stayed a while, and the day was wearing on, and the father-in-law said, oh, stay, you know, spend the night and get up early tomorrow morning and go. But he said, no, this is enough, and they left. So here it is, probably mid-afternoon or so, by the time they actually left and started heading north toward Ephraim. They got up around Jebus, Jerusalem, in the evening, and the servant who was with him said, well, let's go in here. The Levite said, nope, we're not going to spend the night with these foreigners, because at that time it was still occupied by the Jebusites. So he didn't want to go in there. Let's go on to Gibeah or Ramah. So they kept going. And night fell as they were near Gibeah, so they went in. They went and sat down, and nobody took them in. No one in that town offered hospitality, except for the old Ephraimite. He came in from his work in the fields, and he saw them sitting there. He greeted them and talked with them. Who are you? Where are you from? Where are you going? And perhaps because they were, well, he was probably just hospitable anyway, but certainly both having roots in Ephraim, they had a common interest, but he invited them in. He insisted that they come in. It wasn't just an invitation, which makes you think he probably knew the behavior of the people of that town. The parallels here to Sodom and Lot, when the angels visited, are pretty strong. Lot knew how the men of Sodom behaved, and he insisted that the angels not spend the night in the square. This man in Gibeah probably knew of the behavior of the townsmen, and so he said, come into my house. And they did. They had said, oh, we've got all we need except shelter. But he said, come in, let me take care of you. And while they were in, and they washed their feet, and they were eating and drinking, and the people of the town, the men of the town, came and pounded on the door and said, bring the man out, that we may have relations with him. And here's where things really go south. You have to ask a bunch of questions at this point. Why did this even go on? Why was this allowed to go on? This kind of behavior is a stoning offense under the law. Period. You engage in this behavior, you're killed. So why is this going on in this town? Were people just looking the other way? Was it a mob that together was strong enough that nobody could stand against it? They were definitely tolerating stuff that they should not have tolerated. I wasn't going to go there. She said, isn't that like now? And how we are now? And yes, to... We did not nip it in the bud, and it has grown full and come to fruit. So who wants to get involved? I mean, it's like today. I don't want to be involved. You wonder if this was really common in Benjamin, throughout the whole region of Benjamin, because remember, this is what the Benjamites actually defended to the death. But there may be other things involved in that we'll get to a little bit later. Now, the old man, we're getting a little ahead here. These men who came, some translations refer to them as sons of, let me see if I can get this right. Well, it's here. Belial. Most of us just say Belial. Sons of wickedness. Worthless fellows. Good for nothings. Perverted men. Base fellows. These are things from several different translations. But Belial is wickedness or destruction. So these men came and said, bring him out. The old man says, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. And he offered them his virgin daughter and the Levite's concubine. What is going on? Why protect this man and give to women? Saying that may be what he was thinking. After all, with the man, it's a stoning offense. He puts the man out there. Well, let's save that for a bit. But there's such a strong tradition of hospitality. If somebody, even today in that part of the world, if you bring somebody into your house, they are under your protection and you will die before you let them be hurt. That is just the culture. Now, why he was willing to give his daughter and the concubine, you wonder, was the Levite, was he agreeing to this offer? Well, maybe he had a smidge of nobility in him, in that he just seized his concubine and tossed her out and shut the door. What happened? That's a good question. I mean, how did they regard the value of women? Certainly not that highly. Now, the Levite, you wonder, was he doing some kind of calculation in his head of saying, this is the lesser of the evils? As you were saying, you know, for her to be raped was not, well, it was not an offense on her part. He might have been thinking, if I go out there willingly, then I am participating in this, and I am guilty of a stoning offense. I don't know. You know, I'm just speculating here, trying to get inside his head and think, what could he possibly be thinking? Was he so callous that he just said, take her and leave us alone? He did save the old man and his daughter in doing so, but, you know, this is one of those situations of, was there a good way out? And this comes to a question of, they were trying to bargain with evil. They were trying to say, here, take this much and be satisfied with it. Does that ever work? Here, I'll do this one little sin over here so that you leave me in my righteousness alone. Not a good move. Now, a little bit in defense of the Levite. He hadn't done anything wrong up to this point. There was nothing wrong with him stopping in Gibeah and seeking to spend the night there. And I suspect that he didn't know what this town was like, or he wouldn't have gone in there. He was from the remotest parts of the hill country of Ephraim. He was out in the boondocks someplace. Today, you would call him a hillbilly, maybe. I don't mean to be disparaging there, but he was out in the country, away from this area, and probably had no idea what was going on in there. So he was taken unawares. He was taken by surprise, and all of a sudden, here's this situation, smack in his face. What does he do? Put yourself in that position. How well would any of us have responded to that? Yeah. No, it doesn't. It does not speak well for him. Okay. So he tossed them out, and They raped and abused her all night long. And then shortly before morning, they quit, and she crawled back to the door, and that's where he found her. Apparently, he went to sleep. You know, toss her out and go to bed. But he got up in the morning to leave. Oh, let's just take a moment here for the men of Gibeah. Brutal, to say the least. Shameless, vile, you pick anything you want to put in there. They were the embodiment of what we find in Romans 1:32. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. One of them could not have done this alone. One would have been repelled, maybe even killed. But you put a mob together, and now you've got strength. So if you can get the mob going the way you want them to, you can have whatever you want. It has never been different. So the call. The Levite found her dead in the morning. Now, there are some who think she wasn't dead yet, but close to it. And he tossed her on the donkey and went home, and then he cut her up while she was still alive. The text doesn't support that. Now, he did some pretty reprehensible things, but at least we don't have evidence for charging him with that as well. He took her home, cut her up, and sent the pieces out to all of Israel. And the people saw this, and they were appalled. They should be appalled. They were appalled. They said, such a thing has never happened since we came up out of Egypt. I think we're going to see a little more of his character in a little bit. But all the people saw this, and they said, consider it. Take counsel and speak up. Okay? So they all came together. Almost everybody came together at Mizpah, which, by the way, means watchtower or lookout. Mizpah was the highest place in that area, the highest hill. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord. Okay, they had 400,000 men, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. That was a lot of people. And they asked the Levite, tell us, how did this wickedness take place? So he makes his case. We just wanted to spend the night, which was true. And the men rose up against me. Well, sort of, okay. They intended to kill me. Text doesn't say that. They might have been violent enough that he might have ended up dying from it, but that's not what the text says. So here he seems to be starting to embellish his story. And instead, they ravished my concubine so that she died. He doesn't say, I gave them my concubine, but this is the story that he presents. And then when he's done, so what are you going to do about it? Immediately puts the challenge to him. I told you this horrific story, now what are you going to do about it? Behold, all you sons of Israel, give your advice and counsel here. The reaction? Okay, in the modern vernacular, a tweet storm. You all know what I'm talking about? What happens when somebody does something and someone is offended today? It goes on Twitter. And does anybody inquire what was the truth of the situation? Or do they all react emotionally and demand whatever, justice, punishment? Then they say, this is the thing which we will do to give you. They all together rose up as one man and said, this is what we're going to do. There's something missing here. In fact, they go on to essentially condemn the entire tribe of Benjamin to death. Is that according to the law? Could they condemn one person to death according to the law based on the testimony of one person? 10? Two or three witnesses at least. Never was a charge accepted as a one-on-one. So right here, they have ignored the first principle of the law. You don't just take one person's word for it. Now, whether his servant was there and piped up and said, yeah, that's the way it happened, we don't know, but the text doesn't say that, and probably not. This is a mob response, and this is what we're going to do. So what are they going to do? They said, we'll go up by lot against Benjamin. We will take one man out of 10, 10 out of 100, and 100 out of 1,000 to supply them, and we'll go against Benjamin. And they sent messengers throughout all of Benjamin, saying to them, what is this wickedness that has taken place among you? Why is this happening? Give up these men that we can kill them and purge Israel of this wickedness. At least that part of it was appropriate. Benjamin's response, what'd they say? No. You can't have them. Why would they do that? They've got people who have done probably at least 3 stoning offenses, and they're saying, nope, you can't have them. What's going on? Yes.
I think that they took it as an insult. That was their response. They, took it as a challenge.
If we were to look at something like this today, basically what they were doing was saying, here are the extradition papers. Give them to us. States' rights, state sovereignty. This is our tribe. We'll take care of it. Or, to presume the worst, this is what we do in Benjamin, and it's our right.
They had not taken care of it before.
Certainly. Coming back to Pat's comment about today, how many things do we have today that are now protected by the law of the land that would fall under this kind of thing? Specifically, the behaviors that we're talking about here are now protected by the law of this land. You have the power of the state saying, this must be allowed.
Surprising to us how people would set sin when it occurred
That's a real good point. I got to protect my own. So we have, I'm sorry, Harold.
And the sad part about it was that the Benjamites didn't say, well, we will, you know, administer our, you know, a form of justice under God's law. So again, we come back to that thing where God is nowhere near any of, you know, any law of God is nowhere near in their mind. You know, because I can see where the tribe would take care of, you know, such behavior, but they didn't mention any of that. There was nothing, no mention of God.
That's a good point. They did not. They didn't say we'll take care of it.
Right.
It's our problem and we'll deal with it. It was just no.
And I think that
So now we come, they're all gathered together. Israel has 400,000 men. Benjamin has, depending on how you put the numbers together, something like 26,700. If you include those 700 left-handed men from Gibeah. But about 26,000 to 400,000. Israel had a 15-to-1 advantage. Now, why on earth did they not just go up with those numbers and do what they set out to do? Instead, here, for the first time, they now ask God, who shall go up first? They have come together. They have made these oaths and things that we'll talk about shortly. But they, after they had decided what they're going to do, now they ask God's blessing on it. So who's to go up first? Judah. Okay. Judah goes. Judah got nearly wiped out. 22,000 men killed on the first day. Doesn't say anything about how many Benjamin lost. Probably not very many. 22,000 killed on the first day. They were going up thinking, we're going to just take care of this, and then... So they went back and licked their wounds. They encouraged themselves. They built their morale up again. And they asked God this time, shall we go again? He says, yes. So they went up the second day. 18,000 killed that day. They're now down 40,000 men. That's 10% of all that came. Those are serious losses. And now they're not so confident anymore. They fasted, they prayed, they offered sacrifices, and they asked God, should we do this again, or should we just quit? And this time he said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. They didn't ask him for much. It was kind of like, we're going to go do it. Just give us a rubber stamp on this. And they got slapped down. They did it again. And now, when they're finally showing a little humility and saying, should we quit this? He says, I will deliver them into your hand. Remind anybody of anything? Proverbs 21:31. The horse is prepared for the day of battle, but victory belongs to the Lord. The third day, Benjamin lost 25,100 men. Maybe some more. There are a lot of numbers in there when they're chasing them up the roads and catching some and killing some. How that all gets put together is hard to say, but somewhere it said 25,100. They were destroyed. 600 of them fled. Well, of those who fled, 600 made it to the Rock of Rimmon, where they stayed for 4 months. After chasing those, Israel turned around and went through every city and village of Benjamin and killed everybody. Was that justified? Was there authorization for such an action? Or was this just the bloodlust of a mob? Like, you got us, you killed 40,000 of us, man, we are just going. Whose vengeance was it? Way up there at the top, there's the little, well, the big white arrow pointing to where they think was Rimmon. This is, according to Wikipedia, it is the present village of Ramun on the very edge of the hill country with a precipitous descent toward the Jordan Valley. Apparently, this was a very defensible place. Something like cliffs with caves in them where they could go in and you really couldn't get them out. So they stayed there for 4 months. Israel made a lot of oaths in here. They said, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin in marriage. This was one of their things. They all came together and in the mob action. None of us is going to give a daughter to Benjamin. And now they have 600 men of Benjamin left and no women. That's called extinction. And they realize now, uh-oh, we just wiped out a tribe of Israel. Can we fix this? But we have this oath that we made. We can't give them daughters from our tribes because if I give them my daughter, you got to kill me. So they're in trouble. How do they weasel their way around this? Somehow they've got to get past their big talk. Well, they had made another oath saying, if anybody doesn't come up to this mustering, they shall be put to death. So they said, was there anybody who didn't come? And they ran through the list and they found Jabesh-Gilead. No one had come from this city. So they said, they sent out 12,000 men and said, go kill them all, except for young women who have not known a man. So they killed everybody in the city, men, women, children, everything, and they found 400 young virgins, and they brought them back. And they were going to give them to Benjamin, which they did. They then sent word to Benjamin, proclaiming peace, saying, okay, we're done. We're clean slate. Let's go from here. And we have 400 women for you so you can go back to your land and start rebuilding. But that's not enough. They were still missing 200. 200 men without wives and no hope of getting them. They weren't going to get them from the nations around them. They weren't going to get them from the other tribes because they had this oath hanging over their heads. So what else can we do? Now this really stretches the bounds. But they say, we can't give them to them, but if we can arrange for them to be taken, we will not violate our oath. So there was a feast every year at Shiloh. And they told these men of Benjamin, hide in the vineyards, and when the young women come out to dance in this festival, grab one and take her back to your land. And if their fathers or brothers complain to us, we'll say, oh, let them have them, because we didn't take them by force, so here, just let them have them. Catch a wife from the dancers at Shiloh. Take her back to your land and have a family. Now that sounds pretty brutal too, doesn't it? But I have to wonder, could they have kept this secret? Really, could they have kept such a planned secret? I mean, we don't know. But you got to wonder if the word didn't get around and these girls that went out knew that they might get themselves a husband. Not catch a husband, but be caught by a husband. Remember, they didn't have an awful lot of choice in who they married in those days anyway. And for the more adventurous, this would be exciting. I don't mean to be callous about this, but you know, we don't know. And I think, personally, I think it would be difficult to keep such a plan quiet. So maybe they were taken completely by surprise, maybe not. But their plan was, if somebody's upset, we'll take the heat for you. So we come to the end. This is all done. They figure, we've got it all figured out. We've weaseled our way around all those things, and Benjamin now has a way forward. So everything's settled. The sons of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family, and each one of them went out from there to his inheritance. Back to just daily life. And the very ending, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we have no time to discuss that. Next week, think about this. We're going to do a recap of all of Judges, sort of a review and such. Think about this thing. What is going on with this statement about there was no king in Israel? It's mentioned four times here in these last five chapters. And there are people that say, well, this is just kind of propaganda setting people up to accept the monarchy. That's one thing. But also think about all of the things we've studied in Judges. And we've talked about some things like parallels to today. What are our takeaways from the study of Judges? So we should have a very robust discussion next week. We're out of time. Thank you for your attention.